south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. All right, here's an email from an irate young lady. She's got something to say about my show presentation techniques. She says, Johnny, I like the way your show is not at all PC. I appreciate that most of the time, but it's not fair when you fat shame people. I've been a slightly overweight lady all my life and have had tremendous battles trying to get down to what people say or think is a so-called normal weight. It's not easy, it feels bad, and it's nothing to make fun of. Johnny, I'm specifically referring to that show where you talked about airports and overweight people flying coach. Aside from liking or at least finding amusing everything else you talk about on the show, practically everything else, mostly. Just one thing, Johnny. Can you please knock off the fat shaming? Remember, we have feelings too, and if we had a mind to, we could take you down. All right, that's from Dina in Washington, the state. All right, thanks, Dina. You really want to take me down? So, Dina, your beef is, no pun intended, fat shaming. Oh boy, let me tell you something you've never considered. Though it's true, I've never been fat or even slightly overweight. Us so-called skinny people get shamed too. In fact, over the years, I've been skinny-ass, skinny-legged, and skinny-bone-shamed all my life. Oh, and since I've been losing it on the top over the years, I've been hair-shamed a lot lately too. And you know, I've got kind of a honker too, so yes, I've been nose-shamed many times. I've even been silly-walk-shamed by my sisters and a previous ex. You wonder how people can cut up on you for that. Well, it turns out my whole family and one particular ex, who deserves no further mention, they say they can spot me in a crowd blocks away simply because I've got kind of a funny walk. So, Dina, if fat shaming's all you got to worry about, you just might be a little too sensitive. Oh, and if you're wondering if all that ass, leg, hair, honker, shaming, etc. have hurt my feelings or damaged my ego, well, maybe in today's world, if I was the kid up in Chicago, my mom would say, Johnny, we'll get a lawyer and take their parents to court. And these days, there are plenty of stories like that. And that's why so many Latin Americans, when they hear those stories, think it's some kind of a joke that can't really be happening. And when you tell them it's true and it happens all the time, they still don't want to believe it. After all, 90% of Latin Americans would love to live up in the United States. Sueño Americano, you know, American dream and all that. But back to the question, was I damaged in any way by all those little digs people threw at me? Well, not really, not any more than the next guy anyway. I certainly wasn't the only one getting picked on or sometimes bullied. That was a way of life with kids growing up in the States way back when. In fact, I can't think of a single one of us kids who ever saw a shrink. In fact, when I was a kid, we didn't even know what a shrink was. In reality, it was nothing but boys' stuff. We all did it to each other, and I probably felt no damage at all because I never got dick-shamed in the gym class locker room. Yep, there were always one or two kids who fell victim to that. Man, I'll tell you, the other stuff may have hurt a little, but you could defend yourself. Though it was a given and a harsh wake-up call. In the gym class locker room, if you didn't hang with the boys, that was the kiss of death. By the way, ladies, and I'm directing this mostly to ladies, if you haven't figured it out already, body part shaming is part of guy humor. We do that to our buddies all the time. In fact, that's how some guys get their nicknames. I remember in my old neighborhood, there was a guy named Ears, a guy named Chalk, which was short for chalk teeth because his teeth looked like powdered chalk, and another one named Pie Face. What's that tell you? So, ladies, if you're wondering what guys do at exclusively male get-togethers, they talk about sex, sports, work, gadgets, and they spend a hell of a lot of time cutting up on each other. I know, sounds awful infantile, and it is, but hey, that's what men do. That means if you're a guy with a fragile ego and you can't take some ribbing and some body shaming occasionally, man, you're in for it because your buddies will pile it on even more. Of course, the smarter the group of guys you hang with, the more cutting and clever the insults. Again, it's a guy thing. Oh, and how about this for a male cultural observation? I've got a couple of good Latin buddies. Children of the rich, you could call them. They went to private helicopter schools all their lives and university up in the States, so they're 100% fluent in English, bilingual. They're smart guys and can play give and take insults in English as good as many gringos and expats. Except I've noticed when they switch back to Spanish with their own buddies who aren't bilingual, they still joke around and banter in Spanish, but the jokes and insults just aren't as clever or cutting as when they're doing the same with us English-speaking gringos. So what do you make of that? Sounds like a good sociology master's thesis, doesn't it? Okay, so I'm 1,436th Polynesian. Where's my grant money? Just kidding. Am I? But I digress as usual. Where were we? Oh yeah, body shaming. Oh, and I know this since I have three sisters and a mother. I remember this from back in the States. Stateside ladies will rarely body shame another lady to her face, but man, daggers would often fly when someone would leave the room. And as far as Latinas go, they throw their daggers at other Latina ladies too, but mostly with their eyes, not their tongues. That is, unless they've encountered another Latina who's been messing with their guy. Then all bets are off, believe me. Man, you don't want to get in the middle of that. Oh, and get this, Dina says in her email, there's a fine line between fat shaming and bullying. Oh, no. Dina, sounds like a little of that social justice warrioring is rearing its ugly head, huh? Well, thank God, Buddha, Krishna, your lucky stars, and everyone else, that there's a huge lag time here in Latin America regarding social justice warrioring, LGBT, WTFs, safe spaces, and all that. That stuff just does not seem to exist down here yet. Though, like everything from up in the first world, it'll eventually land down here, though in muted form on college campuses. I guess we can call that reason 4,256, why you just have to get that plan B going and get the hell out of Dodge as soon as you possibly can. Speaking of plan Bs, just got this email from the famous Altiplano Drifter. As usual, I'll paraphrase a bit and cut out the parts where he's skinny-ass shaming me. Just kidding. He says, Johnny, what are your thoughts about living in Latin America, specifically Guatemala, over the next 5+ years, as tipping points fall up in the first world, as things and systems deconstruct, and climate change kicks into high gear? That being said, I'm feeling like buying a house or any kind of permanent property purchase at all, even in Latin America, might be unwise, especially if you buy or build and plan on renting it out. First of all, when the mierda hits the fan, tourism would undoubtedly be affected because nearly all the tourism to Latin America is coming from first world countries. And at that point, if you have a property and you're trying to sell it, it'll likely be more, not less difficult as time goes on. Thus, I think a year-by-year lease is the way to go. Then he says, do you feel places like Lake Atitlan in Guatemala are remote enough and self-sustainable enough to do well when the trucks stop rolling for, say, a year or so? And what about water? Is there enough to go around? And is there enough locally grown food to feed all the towns around the lake? And what about all the many small towns all over the place? They need to eat and drink too. So I'm thinking when the big collapse comes, there just might be roving bands of scavengers all over the place looking for food and other items. This would create a survivalist type scenario. Basically the same thing they'll be dealing with up in the States. Only up there you'd have that plus bad weather and heavily armed Big Brother. Then he finishes by saying, it's not fun to talk about this stuff, but better now than never. All right, thanks for that, Mr. Drifter. So what do I have to say about that? I've got something to say about everything, right? Well, no comment. Just kidding. For one thing, here in Latin America, people are always in survivalist mode, and they don't even know it. That's just the way it is. Though they don't use the word survivalist or prepping, that's not in their vocabulary yet. But what you don't realize is that most of the households in Latin America still have routine power outages for minutes, hours, sometimes longer. Of course, you won't, as an expat with a plan B. You'll probably be living in a gated, guarded community or a decent housing development that has its own generator, or you'll have solar or your own generator too. But 95% or more of Latin American households have no such backup plan. They just deal with the fact that once a month, once a week, or once every couple of days, at least for a few minutes anyway, there'll be a power outage. And do they complain about it? Never. It's only us gringos that complain. And about the rainfall? Well, once you get south of the border, that's south of the Mexican border with Guatemala, There's, in fact, way too much rain. Why do you think they call that 6 months of the year the rainy season? Of course, there's also 6 months of dry season, too, where it almost never rains, at least not heavily. Well, that just means you need a big-ass cistern to tide you over when the world does take a crap. You've heard me talk about that and how to set up one of those systems for yourself, collecting your own rainwater from your roof on past shows. It'd be stupid not to have one. And believe me, if you have one, you'll be just fine. So what about food and sustainability if things really heat up, that is, climate change kicks in a big way? Well, here's a fact that I don't think 1 in 10,000 people even know. That is, unless you happen to have your pilot's license. There is a rule of thumb in science that you lose about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 2 degrees centigrade, for every 1,000 feet in altitude above sea level. And in the case of Lake Atitlan, the most beautiful lake in the world, it's right smack dab in the Altiplano. You'll be up around 5 to about 7,000 feet above sea level, depending which little town you happen to be in. Some of them are right on the lake, and some of them are higher up in the mountains. So figure it out. Do the math. If you're at 5,000 feet, which is probably the average if you're right on the lake, that puts you at around 17 or 18 degrees cooler than at sea level at the same latitude on the Earth. Can you handle that? What about plants? Can they handle that? Of course. Just have a look at all the little markets in the Altiplano. They're bringing that stuff in from just a couple of miles around. Those little markets have unbelievable quantities and types of food, and it's all coming in from little truck farms very nearby, also in the Altiplano. So think about it. Even the worst case scenario, let's say in 5 years, the temperature of the entire Earth was raised 3 degrees Fahrenheit. That would be an unheard of increase that would generally take a couple of hundred years. In fact, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in the last 100 years, the Earth's temperature has risen 1.33 degrees Fahrenheit. So a 3-degree increase, if trends continue, would take 200 years. But let's just say for the sake of argument, there was a huge 3-degree increase in just 5 years instead of 200. If you're living out your Plan B at 5,000 feet, in a typical Altiplano region like Lake Atitlan, what's a general 3-degree increase going to do to your lifestyle and the crops they grow there? Well, here's how it would work out. When you're up there at 5,000 feet, 17 to 18 degrees cooler than your friends who elected to have their Plan B, sucking down Mai Tais by the pool at the beach house, which is now reaching daily highs of 90 degrees when it used to be only 87 just a few years ago. So definitely, people living on or near the coast or in very low latitudes will suffer the most. If you've ever been there, you know that 87 degrees is almost comfortable if you're sitting in the shade doing nothing. And if you're directly in the sun, it's unbearable. But now we're assuming daily temperatures aren't 87, but 90. Meanwhile, in the Altiplano, while your friends are suffering 90-degree weather at the coast, your daily high temperature is a mere 73 degrees. That's 17 degrees cooler due to your altitude at 5,000 feet. And that's, of course, up 3 degrees from your normal high of 70. Bottom line, for people at the coast and at sea level, it's a terrible thing. But for you up in the Altiplano, big deal. So then what about those bands of apocalyptic zombie scavengers? Well, maybe at sea level, if the crops start failing, but I can't see that happening in the Altiplano. But again, you should have a nice big cistern, some auxiliary solar, and maybe 2 100-pound tanks of propane gas. That would just be for cooking and would probably last you 2 years. So it's my guess that in the Altiplano, life will go on, though it won't be a painful and frantic life like it'll be for people living in low altitudes and on the coast. And that brings us to another question I often get from people in emails and otherwise. They're always asking, what's the perfect Plan B? Man, that's like saying, what's the perfect car or the perfect job or the perfect mate? The answers are so individual. But there are some important things to consider that'll get you a long way on the road to figuring out what your perfect Plan B is. Of course, cost and location are the biggest considerations for most people, especially when looking for a property. Because eventually, you know, even though we recommend to rent for 6 months to a year, gringos and expats usually end up buying something. If not as an investment, just to diversify their assets and not keep it all in cash or gold or a retirement plan, IRA, or just one thing. And again, you have to decide which elevation you're comfortable with. What kind of weather do you like? Do you want four seasons? Do you want rainy and dry season? Do you want altiplano? Do you want to live by a beach? Another thing is, many gringos and expats plan to have a garden or even a little farm. But what crops do you want to grow? Or what plants or trees or fruits you want to grow? And how good is your Spanish? As you know, there are a lot of places in Latin America you can get along without any Spanish at all. Of course, those will be gringo-wise areas that are a lot more expensive, too. And what about your hobbies? Suppose you want to own some guns. You know, there are lots of Latin countries where it's difficult to own a gun, and others where it's quite easy. All you have to do is be a resident. Another big consideration, especially with new green gringos, is that they sometimes need to have a soft landing and therefore prefer to be around gringos, at least at first. So they start out with a plan B on or near a well-known gringo tourist trail. One of the problems is, though, that after a while, some gringos and expats become disillusioned with living around all those gringos and tourists, and they give up and move back to Cleveland instead of doing what I always recommend, moving farther and farther away from the gringo tourist sites where it's cheaper and more relaxed. And of course, the farther away you get, the more real your Latin American experience is. Not to mention, the farther you get away from gringo tourist sites, the stronger your gringo advantage. Oh, and if you choose to homestead, that is, live in a pretty remote area, a lot of gringos want to have a big spread that's nearly self-sufficient. Fruit trees, vegetables, animals, dogs, horses, the works. However, if you choose to live in a remote area, so-called campo, how comfortable are you with living near and around other country folks, or campesinos, who in some ways might seem like they're living in the 1940s? Nothing wrong with that. They're true survivors. You could learn a lot from them, but they're not going to speak English. In fact, the nearest house just might be an adobe hut with a wood plank floor. That means to your neighbors, you seem to be living in a mansion. Nothing wrong with that either. There's always some rich guy in the neighborhood. Why can't it be you for a change? Oh, and another thing, if you live in a remote area, how good are you at do-it-yourself stuff? Are you pretty much self-sufficient? Or are you figuring if something breaks, you'll just go on YouTube and suss it out? What I mean is, can you change the oil in your car or do a brake job? Can you change a light bulb? Don't lie to me now. Oh, and if you live out in the boonies, what's your security plan? You have to have one, you know. A good start is getting a nice big dog or a not-so-nice big dog. That would be even better. Well, here's a question for expat gringas. If you're thinking your plan B is going to be out in the boonies, how well can you handle insects and snakes, or just the thought of insects and snakes? Now, I don't want to get you paranoid about snakes. I've been living here 28 years now, and I've only seen maybe 5 snakes fairly up close and personal in all that time. But not that close to scare me, only put me on alert. So 5 snakes in 28 years, that's about 1 every 5 or 6 years. Now, get this through your head. They don't want to mess with you. They see you, they want to turn tail and run. That is, if they had feet. The Bible says they used to, right? Anyway, the only time you're ever going to have to really tangle with one is if you happen to step on him. And the good news is, I don't know of a single gringo or expat who's ever been bitten. Of course, it seems every gardener and maintenance man has his story. I mean, that's why they have machetes, right? But as for gringos and expats, once in a great while, we do see one. Thankfully, at a distance. However, regarding insects, man, there are a lot of bugs down here. But surprisingly, there are few in the altiplano. However, if you live next to any kind of body of water or river, that's another story. Then again, there's always certain people who seem to attract bugs, like mosquitoes. Luckily, I'm not one of those. I must be too caustic for them. They usually go for someone else. Then there's those ever-present cucarachas. Man, I hate those things. I'll tell you, it's because of the existence of flies, mosquitoes, and cucarachas. I doubt the existence of God. Or if he does exist, he's a hell of a trickster. You have to ask yourself, why do such disgusting creatures exist? Oh, it's true, there's lots of disgusting, despicable creatures out there, but very few of them bother us, like flies, mosquitoes, and cucarachas. However, if you take minimum precautions and have a decently sealed up house, you won't have flies or mosquitoes. But cucarachas, man, some houses are so full of them, it's like they own the place and you're the guest. Though it does not have to be like that at all. However, as far as Latino culture, they just learn to live with them. I mean, look, they've even got a hugely popular song about them, La Cucaracha. Of course, there are gringos and expats that come from the southern states that seem to tolerate cucarachas 100 times more than us gringos and expats from farther up north. You know, there's a completely cheap and non-toxic way to get rid of them in 2 weeks. Little cucaracha balls. You make up a batch of this stuff, kind of like cookie dough consistency. Roll up about 25 little pea-sized balls. Put them where cucarachas like to run at night. That'd be in kitchen cabinets, behind the stove, microwave, and refrigerator. Don't forget to put them in the corners in your bathrooms, too. You could whip up a batch in 5 minutes for around a buck. And I'd say a batch lasts you maybe 2 months. And after you've killed off the first wave and the next generation or two, you probably don't have to put any down for another year or so. All right, Johnny, what's the recipe? Well, you take a small cereal bowl. Put a level teaspoon of brown sugar in there. Add 2 level teaspoons of regular flour. And finally, 1 level teaspoon of boric acid. That's B-O-R-I-C, acid, boric acid. It's a powder, and you can get it at any welding supply because it's used as a flux. Or order it from Amazon for around 10 bucks a pound. And a pound, that will last you a lifetime, believe me. So it's 1 part boric acid, 2 parts flour, and 1 part brown sugar. Then you start adding a little water until you have the consistency of cookie dough or Play-Doh. And do use rubber gloves while you're mixing it. Not that it's toxic, it just sticks to everything, like cookie dough does. You see, boric acid is a very sharp-edged crystal, and when they eat the stuff, it tears up their guts and kills them. So then what about toxicity to humans? Well, it turns out the LD50 on boric acid is around 50 grams. Now, LD50 is a common term in chemistry. It's the dosage you need to kill 50% of any humans exposed to it. That means you'd have to down around 12 level teaspoons of the stuff. So for all intents and purposes, the stuff's non-toxic, except to cucarachas and other insect pests that might want to nibble on it. By the way, just to prove how safe that borax really is, remember 20 Mule Team Borax? It's still around, I guess. You can get it on Amazon too, but it was a very popular laundry detergent consisting mostly of powdered boric acid. Chances are your grandma used it all the time. Used to be a lot of ads for it on TV when I was a kid. Though the question of the ages is, how many cucaracha balls that are so effective on cockroaches would you need to kill Keith Richards? Because you know what they say, after a nuclear war, only 2 things will survive, cockroaches and a certain Rolling Stone. By the way, the kind of cucarachas I particularly can't stand are those big-ass ones that could be up to 2 or 3 inches long. Ugh! I tell you, when I go into a person's house, gringo or Latino, and I see one of those things scurrying around, man, your first instinct is to step on it. But don't do that. Unless you don't mind his disgusting, munged-up guts and possibly his carcass stuck to the bottom of your shoe. Solution? Easiest thing in the world. Make up some of your own kooka balls. Now, I know I mentioned this on a show maybe 4 or 5 years ago, but it's worth repeating. I'll tell you, talk about first impressions. How would you feel if you were in someone's kitchen, you watched them put something in the microwave oven, and as they opened the door, a cockroach scurried out, or worse yet, scurried in? Well, I've seen that more than a few times, and it ain't pretty. I guarantee it's going to weigh heavily on your decision to eat over. And don't give me that crap about how they're everywhere and you just have to get used to them. I got to tell you, it's the absolute truth that I've probably seen 2 cucarachas where I live in the past year. And where do you think I found them? In the laundry room where the maintenance guy eats his lunch. What's that tell you? All right, speaking of climates, altitudes, and altiplanos, one thing is certainly true. Within an hour's drive of practically anywhere in Latin America, especially Central America, you'll find every different kind of climate there is. Barring snow and frost, of course, except down in Argentina and Chile and certain mountains in the Andes. So if you're out driving for even an hour, sometimes, especially in Central America, you could hit 3 or 4 different mini climates, or in Spanish, mini climas. And that's why all those hot-looking Latina TV weather ladies are always right, and they're always wrong, too. Talk about the easiest job in the world. They don't have to be meteorologists like they do up in the States. They only have to be retardashian-like physically and read at a fourth-grade level. But back to insects for a second. I get a lot of questions about insects, especially since almost everyone who's never really visited Latin America thinks it's like the Latin America you see in James Bond movies. A lot of desert, cactus, rattlesnakes, and big-ass, disgusting politicians. I mean, scorpions. Well, yeah, that's what a lot of Mexico is like, and parts of Chile and Peru, too. But for the most part, the rest of Latin America's got those 2 seasons, heavy rain and dry. So where you've got lots of rain, you'll have lush greenery and lots of insects. And in those desert areas, almost no greenery or insects to speak of at all. You see, in most of Latin America, they've got annual rainfall of 30 to 100 inches a year. That's a hell of a lot. That means absolutely no shortages of water if you plan right and have a nice big cistern. And if you're in the desert area, which I don't recommend at all, but some people choose to live there, you could have less than 10 inches of rain a year. That means you'll definitely need municipal water or a well, probably a very deep well, down 500 feet or so. Again, you have to do some investigating and rent for at least 6 months before you buy. Do you want to have a plan B in a place where you're always short of water? I don't think so. Naturally, your preferences are personal, and if you're looking for property, you shouldn't let the opinions of others influence you too much. You have to live there at least 6 months yourself. Why? Because some people accept insects as a trade-off because they like subtropical hot climates and being close to the ocean. At least that's what some people tell themselves before they actually move down there and experience it for themselves. Whereas others, like me, prefer the altiplano with cooler temperatures, spring-like weather all year round, where you don't have a heating or air conditioning bill. Of course, you have to plan to have airflow and skylights and stuff, but you long-term listeners knew that already, right? Then there's other expats and gringos who like to live very high up at 10 or even 12,000 feet. That means no air conditioning, but a heating bill because it will get cold. Oh, and remember, no matter where you plan on renting or buying, you have to depend on the locals, mostly the old timers, to tell you how the flood conditions are. Because during the rainy season, even if you're way up on the altiplano, if the angles and the drainage paths aren't right, there'll be temporary floods. You'll find that out the first time you drive during the rainy season. Turns out, for an hour or two anyway, roads are always getting flooded out. Of course, that's due to bad design, bad road construction, bad civil engineering. Nevertheless, even when you're up 5,000 or 6,000 feet, things flood. So what to do? Well, ask the oldest guy walking through the neighborhood with his machete. He'll have the longest memory and be an eyewitness to at least the 50-year floodplain. All right, once again, we're getting towards the end of the show. We'll finish off this little bit on sustainability on the next show. There are lots of points to consider when mapping out your own plan B. We'll get to that. But before you go, I'd like to remind you to pick up my 100-page Latin American healthcare report. Learn how you can get first-world healthcare at third-world prices, with third-world prices being around a fifth of what you'd pay for the very same thing up in the first world. You'll learn about how to select doctors, clinics, healthcare plans, etc. Check it out by going to theexpatfiles.com/healthcare. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!